From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib takes the oath of office, ready to represent the 13th District.
I ran because I have this pit in my stomach of desire to push back against corporate greed. I've always been that way.
How will her years as a state lawmaker help Gretchen Whitmer now that she's our governor?
I don't know how it can't make a difference of understanding relationships, understanding how to reach across party lines to get things done.
The government shutdown means no federal dollars for Michigan's Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians, breaking a promise made nearly two centuries ago.
But we traded 14 million acres of land in Michigan alone for the pledge for those health, education, and social welfare. And so we're reliant on those funds because they are due to us.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Big changes in Washington today as Democrats take over the House of Representatives. Party leaders like newly elected House Speaker Nancy Pelosi promise the president will face congressional oversight for the first time since he took office. The House of Representatives will be the most diverse in U.S. history, with more women than ever before, including the new Democratic representative from the 13th District, Rashida Tlaib. I spoke with her late Wednesday as she prepared to take the oath of office today. You know, I dug back. Let's go to a little bit of history. I dug back into our archives. The first time you were with us on Stateside was April 15th, 2013. You were a state representative from the 6th District. You were one of 56 young state and local elected officials. Do you remember this? You wrote a letter to then Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, House Speaker John Boehner, and House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi demanding immigration reform. And here we are, still fighting over immigration.
I know. But now at least I'm in the car, as I say.
You're in the car. Now, there has been so much focus placed on you as being one of the first two Muslim women being sworn into Congress and the first Palestinian-American woman elected to the House. Do you welcome that, or do you want to just kind of turn that down and just be the member of Congress from the 13th District?
I am so much more than the so-called first. And I didn't run to be the first. I ran because I have this pit in my stomach of desire to push back against corporate greed. I've always been that way, from if it was Maddie Maroon who's trying to build a bridge without a permit to the Koch brothers dumping petroleum coke on the riverfront. I'm so much more than just a person that people are saying is making history as a Muslim, is Arab and Palestinian, all these things. Even at home in Detroit, where I was born and raised, in the Wayne County neighborhoods that elected me, so many of them, you know, voted for me and supported me because they knew I wasn't going to sell them out. And they knew I had a strong work ethic. And, you know, my first bill is Justice for All Civil Rights Act. It's so much embedded into pushing back against corporations that discriminate, especially car insurance companies and so much more. But I know that even when I was the first member in the Michigan legislature, how it took some time for people to see beyond that and to see that, oh, wow, she's a lawyer and she fights against, big fights, especially against corporate polluters. And, you know, environmental justice issues are important to me, and so much on the issue around education and equity and funding, and so much more than that. And I think people know that. I'm a Michigander. I'm a Detroiter. Born and raised, so much a product of that. But at the same time, I want to always honor my parents, honor, the history that they're part of. And the fact that I am making history and being one of the first Muslim women. But there's so much more than that. And I can tell you what makes me so much more inspired is the fact that I got elected by a majority community that is non-Muslim and non-Arab. This is a majority African-American white community. A lot of people think that I represent a huge Arab or Muslim community. I don't. It's less than 5%. And what I love is the other Muslim American woman, Ilhan Omar from Minnesota, same thing, 70% white community. It's fellow American people that don't share the same faith as we do are the ones who elected us. I think that is such a powerful, inspiring story of hope, and the fact that we as a country, like, there's nowhere else that someone like myself, who has parents that didn't reach high school, that is the first to graduate from high school and college, is now going to be a member of the United States Congress. Even though we grew up poor, even though we are not part of what you call political dynasty, I'm not part of this kind of establishment machine that is in politics. I did it through hard work and through not selling out my neighbors and fighting for what was right.
As the national spotlight has been fixed on you since the election, there have been critical voices. Conservative pastor E.W. Jackson complained, I'm going to quote him here, the floor of Congress is going to look like an Islamic republic. We are a Judeo-Christian country. What do you do with those kinds of comments?
I'm an American, and so much of who I am represents the fact that we are a unique country. You know, you don't have a Canadian dream or a German dream. It isn't only the American dream. And so much of who I am and so much of my story and the story of my parents is so much embedded into the history, the rich history of our country. You know, just to quote my colleague Ilhan Omar from Minnesota, you're just going to have to deal because we are truly a reflection of the American people. So much of who we are is reflective of our values and reflective of why we are such a unique country and why there is no other country that can tell you stories like ours. You know, where she's a refugee that came here, I think, as 8 years old, and me didn't speak English when I started school and coming from a really challenged background and community and so forth. I have to tell you, I mean, if there's anything I know, there's more people out there that are so excited about people like myself being elected, being here. I keep telling people here when they run into me, they think I'm staff or something, they hold me up as security, and I say, oh no, I'm a new member. And they're like, oh, we're really sorry, come on in. I said, don't worry. I know we're getting younger and more colorful. And I love that. I love that we are part of a large incoming class of diverse and young and women and mothers and all these things that I think are so spectacular about how we can really start connecting with the American people is by making sure that government is reflective of all of us.
As you become Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, tell us more about that first bill, the Justice for All Civil Rights Act.
It is a bill that I'm so passionate about. Justice for All Civil Rights Act is going to expose the fact that, yes, 50 years ago we passed the historic act in 64, Civil Rights Act of 64, and it was diluted and in a way by the courts as they became increasingly more conservative. Judges started interpreting it in a way that allowed corporations to discriminate, especially car insurance companies that and continue to practice insurance redlining. And one of the things that I want to do is restore what the original intent is and push back against corporations and corporate greed, where you can say, yes, you have to show intent, but you also can show that the impact of the policy in itself on the ground is discriminatory in practice. If you look at, for instance, driver's license responsibility fee right here in Michigan, you know that that was discriminating against low-income families, especially African-American males. And that should be enough to say there's a violation of someone's civil rights. It should not be at this higher threshold that these courts, again, layered with conservative judges, have changed what that it's supposed to have been intended to protect us from. And so Justice for All Civil Rights Act is going to open us up to looking at education and equity in our country. It's going to open up to looking at why, just alone in the 13th Congressional District, less than half of my families don't own their own home. They don't have access to mortgages. So many of my families are going to see that a lot of these practices that we assume that the 1964 Civil Rights Act protected us from, it actually doesn't anymore because of what the courts have decided to do, which is dilute it in a way that allows corporations to thrive.
What do you believe is the way to end this government shutdown, get federal workers back on the job and back to getting paid? How should this Democrat-controlled House respond to the president's demand for money to build the wall?
Look, we need to grow up here. You know, I think for me, I come with the lens. I'm a mother. I don't come as a Republican or Democrat. I'm a mother. I come in, I look at things so much more focused through that lens. I don't know how to describe it, but when I do come in, I see what the impact is. I don't just look and see, what did I run on? What am I? It's like, grow up. I tell everybody in the room, sometimes I want to clear out the room and just put some of us new members on there that are fresh from talking to the American people who are tired about the divisiveness, about this continuation we feel like of the campaigning, the ugliness that happens during these election season. It's festered into what we have now, which is a shutdown of our government. I mean, there are museums here. We're here now and people are like not getting paid for the work that they're doing currently. What it's going to take is the fact that you have to be responsible as a public servant. You cannot let people down so easily because you want to show that, oh, I ran on this, this is what I'm going to do. No, do it in a way where you can gain people's support on both sides of the aisle. Convince them that this is something that's important. Don't bully us. Don't intimidate people. And then who are the ones who hurt the most? Are the people, the American people. If you think about my neighbors and everybody that's impacted by it, the one who works at a federal building, all of those people are mothers and fathers and daughters and people that are really dependent on us to grow up and do what's right. And I'm so tired of people doing a lazy approach of trying to intimidate, trying to bully, and trying to do it in this way, because who gets hurt the most is not the members of Congress or the President of the United States. It is the people back home. And that's what's so frustrating. And I'm hoping that my second vote after the rules vote is going to be reopening our government.
And as you talk to the people of the 13th, your constituents, what are you hearing from them? What do they need from you and want from you as their representative in Congress?
They tell me in all different ways, but very direct, don't back down, Rashida, and don't sell us out. And I hear them because they say, don't be one of those that comes and we support them and then changes and somehow becomes disconnected with what's happening to us every single day. And that's why I'm going to create 3 neighborhood service centers throughout the 13th congressional district, where getting my residents through everyday issues is going to go hand in hand with legislative work. That's how I'm going to stay connected to them and rooted in community. And if I'm not there every single week coming home to see, oh, there was a fire in the neighborhood, or there is a corporate polluter that's really hurting a neighborhood in my district, or there is a school district that's struggling, all of those things are going to be something that I can see and live through with my neighbors and with my residents. And that's what they want. They want somebody that doesn't come here and gets enthralled into the culture here and gets completely disconnected and forgets their way. And that's something that I tell them, you know, being the eldest of 14, being a mother who has their children there, raising them, and I'm living in Michigan, I'm coming here to work for them, but I'm going to be there breathing the same air, sending my kids to the same schools. All of that is so important.
Tell us what you're going to wear at your swearing in.
So it's a Palestinian thobe. It's a dress with all these beautiful designs like flowers, birds, certain things like that. But when you see it, it brings you back to that kind of culture, the Palestinian culture. A lot of people in Jordan and other parts of the Middle East wear this dress. And so I'm wearing my mother's Palestinian thobe tomorrow. She's ecstatically happy. With any child, and you're a child of immigrants, they want you so much to succeed and so much to have the opportunities that they didn't get access to, but at the same time, remember your roots and remember where you came from. And so I think this is so much to honor her sacrifice, to honor her and who she is, and very much is embedded in who I am today. And I'm really excited for her more than anything.
Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, thank you for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, sports commentator John Eubakin with some final thoughts on this year's forgettable football season. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, the season's over, lockers are cleaned out, and now the soul searching begins for coaches Matt Patricia, Jim Harbaugh, and Mark D'Antonio. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubakin is here. And John, I can't stop thinking of lines written by Ernest Thayer back in 1888. Somewhere men are laughing and somewhere children shout, but there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out. So you substitute Wolverines, Spartans, and Lions for Mighty Casey, and there really is no joy in Mudville right now, is there?
You can add the EMU Eagles and the Western Michigan Broncos.
That's
because
right.
The state of Michigan went 0-4 in bowl games this year, so not a lot of joy this holiday season football-wise.
Let's start with the Lions. You know, just when you expect them to lose, they go and shut out Green Bay and hurt their draft position by winning that last game of the season.
By the way, what does that tell you? These guys can't even lose right.
Jim Bob.
For listeners out there, by the way, at the end of the season, the lowest team gets the highest pick for the next NFL draft, the best college players. So at this point, you might as well lose, basically.
And they didn't.
They can't get that right.
And Jim Bob Cooter is out. We don't get to be talking our favorite name anymore.
That's right.
On a grading scale of A to F, how much does Cooter's firing help the 6-10 Lions?
It only depends on who they replace him with. If the next guy's no better, then it's no better. So they have to go out there and get a serious offensive coordinator. Look, Stafford's only got so many miles left in his tires. He's a quarterback, of course, a very expensive quarterback. And
that they're kind of stuck with.
Thanks to their silly contract, which is $135 million, which is insane. But anyway, they have 2, 3, 4 years left with that guy. And you better get somebody fast to get to help him out.
Where does all this leave this 6-10 season, Coach Patricia and GM Bob Quinn?
Surprisingly disappointing, frankly. I thought they'd do a lot better. Both these guys come from the New England Patriots, the most successful by far NFL franchise this century. And they laid an egg, basically. So you got to give these guys time. You're stuck with them now anyway. So 2-3 years at least, I think, to find out what's going on, unless they lose their team. But not good.
Well, now let's turn to the sorry result of the Peach Bowl for Michigan and the Red Box Bowl for Michigan State. How did the wheels come off for both teams, both the Wolverines and Spartans?
In the case of the Wolverines, two ways. First, slowly and then very fast. is almost a mimic of the Ohio State game, where the first half was a great struggle, tug of war, about what you expected with two very good teams. And then in both cases, bad turnovers in the third quarter is what killed them. At Ohio State, it's a blocked punt for a touchdown. At Florida, it was a interception, could have been a touchdown, instead of an interception, going back the other way, and soon enough they score. So then it just, the wheels came off badly.
And for the Spartans?
They have no offense. It's very hard to win without scoring points. They have averaged fewer than 8 points per game the last four games. That's baseball stuff, not football stuff. Horrible.
And, of course, there's a lot of howling on Twitter to fire offensive coordinator Dave Warner.
I'm not usually a fan of howling on Twitter, but in this case, howling on Twitter is correct.
Now, what about the howling on Twitter that happened as the Peach Bowl was going on, that it was time to for Jim Harbaugh to go?
Insane. Absolutely insane. This guy has won 10 games, 3 of the last 4 seasons. People forgot what 2008 to 2014 were like, with half the stands empty. Everyone miserable, and you're not going to any bowl game at all because you're 5-7.
What about the
Interview? 10 is more than 5, and that's how many games he's winning.
What about the Harbaugh being wooed by the NFL buzz?
Happens every single week, and I ignore most of this on Twitter. Once in a while, it gets to a certain point, you have to respond to it, and my answer is always the same. Look, I mean, Jim may or may not be at Michigan forever. I don't know. Maybe Jim doesn't know, but I have seen zero signs whatsoever of him flirting, considering, entertaining any ideas from the NFL. And I've seen 100 signs that he's staying, including, by the way, that his family likes it here and his parents moved in next to him. That's not for the hell of it.
All right. I have to ask you, John, about some reporting by Will Hobson in the Washington Post, who tells us the president of the Outback Bowl, Jim McVay, makes more than $1 million, the highest paid bowl executive in the country in 2017. And his one job is contracts, sponsorships, and tickets for the Outback Bowl. What does this say to you about bowl world?
It's insane, which I've been saying for a while. Yeah. The bowl system is corrupt. And I'll go back to Michael Kinsley, who famously said, "What is shocking is not what's illegal. What's shocking is what's legal." And this does not break any rules. And man, it should, because he's getting $1 million to sponsor one game. All right, the coaches and the ADs all get bonuses for going to a bowl game, more for winning a bowl game. And what do the players get? $500 worth of swag, sweatsuits, or an Xbox, or whatever else. It's an insane system. It's pretty hard to get mad at the players for skipping these things when these guys are making so much money off their back.
Michigan Radio's sports commentator, John Eubacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
The big takeaway from Governor Gretchen Whitmer's inaugural speech this week, her call for compromise, bipartisan cooperation, and the promise she'll be a governor for everyone. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is thinking about that promise as it bumps up against the political realities of a Democratic governor and a GOP-controlled legislature. Daniel, you say compromise is a quaint concept. Why is that?
Well, it's because it's not part of the political ethos today. I think you see it playing out in Washington today, in fact, in continuing negotiations over the shutdown. The Democratic House will be seated today. Nancy Pelosi will become, by all accounts, the speaker yet again of the House. And I think the Democrats will tell you they're trying to get the president to compromise, but he clearly is indicating that he's not going to compromise, or he doesn't plan to, and believes that it's a play for his base. And I think we see a lot of base plays in politics. We see it at the state level. We saw it certainly when Jennifer Granholm was governor, and her base was organized labor, the teachers' unions, and a lot of her policy was tilted in that direction.
And one would say the same with Governor Snyder. His base was the business community.
Yes, but I would sharpen it a little bit more and say that in the legislature, Republicans in the legislature had a much more conservative base, I think, than the governor did at the time. And so, I mean, that is natural in politics, but I think it's become kind of the way politics are done. More and more what I see is the exercise of politics is really not the art of persuasion. It's the exercise of raw political power.
But, you know, you stop and you think, isn't compromise and bipartisanship what voters are demanding? I mean, don't legislators and the governor ignore that at their own peril come election day?
Well, you'd like to think. I think you look at, as I think I pointed out in today's column, you look at divided government and you say that implicit in that is that voters want compromise. I'm not really sure that's true, and I'm not sure that the people who are elected necessarily interpret it that way. And as a result, you tend to get a lot more people who get a lot more dug in. But I don't think there's any question that a lot of the issues that face Michigan, whether the two biggest ones that come to mind are infrastructure and educational attainment, both of those things affect everybody, regardless of whether you have an R or a D next to your name, or you consider yourself an independent, they affect your children, they affect your community, they affect your quality of life. We all have a vested interest in trying to solve some of these issues. And I think anybody who, whether you drive down to Ohio like I did to visit your mother after Christmas, you're reminded yet again of, you go over the state line, and it's like you go blah, 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 and they go,
true.
You know, it's amazing. And the same thing with educational attainment. It doesn't matter if you live in Bloomfield Hills, Birmingham, Detroit, Flint, whatever your community, the educational attainment of your public schools is declining relative to other states.
We're coming off 8 years of having a governor who didn't have a lick of political experience, who was not comfortable with politics. How do you think things could be different with Governor Whitmer?
Well, I think they ought to be. Look, she was a Senate minority leader. She has political experience. Rick Snyder and Jennifer Granholm had absolutely zero in the legislature. You have to go back, obviously, to John Engler, who was a real wheeler and dealer and a muscle man in the legislature, to find somebody with that kind of experience. And I think when you bring that into the governor's office, it has to make a difference. I don't know how it can't make a difference of understanding relationships, understanding how to reach across party lines to get things done. Gretchen Whitmer was the minority leader, not the majority leader. So in order to get some of the things realized that she wanted to get realized, and her party wanted to get realized, she had to work with Republicans. She had to work with Rick Snyder in his first term. If she is not able to deliver on this bipartisanship, I think a lot of the blame will, to some extent, fall to her. And why do I say that? Because the chief executive's job is to sell their policy. It is not the job of the opposition to endorse the policy. Whether it's Barack Obama trying to deal with a Republican Congress or now Donald Trump dealing with a Democratic House, their job is to sell and to try and persuade people to support them on what they believe to be key policy issues. It's not the job of the opposition to bless whatever the chief executive puts forth.
But I think a lot of voters might say it might be the job of the opposition to stop putting party before state or party before country.
Oh, I would agree with that. And I think that's where the rubber meets the road. And that's why I come back to the point I made at the top about confrontation. We're living in an era of polarization where party oftentimes, if not always, does come first. And as a result, a lot of things don't get accomplished. What happens is voters get more and more frustrated. And one result of that is the election of Donald Trump. I mean, I think you see voters that got so frustrated with what they saw, dysfunction in Washington, things that were being done along straight party lines. We could go down the list as I did in the column, whether it's Obamacare or it's the Trump tax cuts that were pushed through by Republicans without Democratic votes. I mean, that's just the way people are doing things. And I think voters are getting increasingly frustrated with that and saying, we want to change. And if we have to put a bull in a proverbial china shop in Washington and Donald Trump, what is it we're going to do? And enough people did it in enough states that he won the Electoral College and now he's president.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Many Americans who don't work for the government have yet to feel any real impact from the shutdown, which began December 20th. But if you depend on federal funding for basic services because of long-ago promises, these are challenging times. Native American tribes all across the country are feeling the crunch from this federal shutdown. Here with us is the chairman of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians, Aaron Payment. Welcome back to Stateside.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Aaron. And it is a challenging new year for your tribe. Take us back in history, Aaron, and explain to us why are tribes like yours so dependent on federal dollars?
So I don't like to use the term dependent. I would say we're reliant on federal dollars. When we entered the treaties, in Michigan in particular, in 1836, we entered a treaty that connected the peninsulas, and then Michigan was able to become a state as a result of it 1 year later. And in that exchange, the federal government promised health, education, and social welfare as long as the grass grows, the winds blow, and the rivers flow. And so that's forever, and we don't have the ability to take the land back. The valuation is much more than we will ever receive, but we traded 14 million acres of land in Michigan alone for the pledge for those health, education, and social welfare. And across the country, tribes traded 500 million acres of land that made this country great. And so we're reliant on those funds because they are due to us in exchange for the land transfer. And it's incorporated within our programs and services administrations. Many tribes supplement that to a great extent with gaming revenue or enterprise revenue. My tribe is an example. We give 100% of our net revenue, or about $18 million, is pledged towards programs and services and operations. And so right now it is integral in our budget that we need these federal dollars in order to operate.
So give us a sense of how this government shutdown has directly impacted your tribe. What programs, what services?
Okay, so first we do have a kind of a shorter term memory of the last time it happened in 2013, and we ended up eating or losing roughly $1 million for the shutdown that happened in 2013. Right now we estimate that the daily cost for the shutdown is about $100,000 to our tribe. And how we're surviving through this time period, although that's about to change if there's another drawdown that's interrupted, is that we, my council voted to appropriate money from our reserves and our unexpended tribal support dollars. And so that's roughly about a week and a half to 2 weeks of expenses that we can survive with. After that, we will have to, everything will be on the table. We'll be looking at layoffs and furloughs, reduction in operations. We have law enforcement coverage. You know, whereas a government, we have the full range of services that we provide to our people, and all of that will have to be looked at. The deadline that we're looking at is January 15th as kind of a critical date, that if the government doesn't reopen, that's a critical time period.
And when we think of services, are we talking, you know, you mentioned law enforcement, are we talking health care, are we talking, basic human needs?
Yes, and I would say that the most acute focus would be on emergency needs that we have for our people. Heating assistance is another one. We have in cooperation with the USDA, we do a food distribution for our members, and the food supplies during a government shutdown will be interrupted. And so even if we were to supplement it with our own money, we aren't going to get those foods supplies from the federal government. Another really big one is health. I think that's easily the largest component of our delivery system, about $30 million a year that we get from the federal government. And then we earn about $10 million in third-party revenues off of different insurances, including the Affordable Care Act. All of that is likely to be interrupted. And what we would try to do is we would try to make sure that we had our walk-in clinic would continue, and we would have emergency care. We would continue that and figure out how to pay for it. But hospital appointments and visits and all of that would be interrupted.
Aaron, what can be done to ensure that tribal resources are protected and maintained during future shutdowns?
So I'm very encouraged because I'm in Washington, D.C., and by the time this airs, we will have two American Indian women added to Congress, the first two in our history. We do have two American Indian males that are in Congress. So the two that are already in Congress have sponsored legislation, and they'll have to re-sponsor it because we're at the end of a legislative session, that will include exempting tribes from the effects of sequestration and making mandatory funding that comes to tribes. So that's important, and I think most people can buy into that idea, although everybody suffers through shutdowns and it's unfair for everybody. But the reason why tribes should not be affected by it is because we prepaid for this. We've already paid for the resources that are supposed to be coming back to our tribe. And so Congressman Mark Wayne Mullins and Congressman Tom Cole have supported mandatory funding and advanced funding or advanced appropriations so that we're not affected the next time. And then also we'll be joined by Congresswoman Deborah Holland from New Mexico and Cherise Davids from Kansas. And we believe that they're very strong voices and they can influence on both sides of the aisle members of Congress to help out tribes. And we have a lot of support among Congress, and we believe that we can get this done.
Aaron Payment, chairman of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. Always great to talk with you, Aaron. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we continue our discussion about Michigan's homeschool laws. Yesterday, we heard an argument for requiring the state to check on kids' safety and academic progress. Today, we hear from someone who says adding more regulation hurts loving, law-abiding parents and does little to address the risk of child abuse. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan has some of the loosest homeschooling laws in the nation. We are one of 11 states that does not require any contact with state or local officials while kids are being homeschooled. On yesterday's program, we heard from Rachel Coleman of the Coalition for Responsible Home Education as she talked about her concerns that homeschooled children could slip through the cracks, even end up in dangerous situations. Coleman wants to see Michigan increase oversight of families that homeschool. Today, another side to that debate. Mike Donnelly is an attorney for the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. He works with homeschool families across the state. Mike, first off, what is the Homeschool Legal Defense Association? What do you do?
HSLDA is a national advocacy organization for home educating families. We provide support for families who are home educating their children. We provide services to them to help them educate successfully and to make homeschooling possible. We have 80,000 member families all over the world. And when you look at home education, you see that it's a growing movement here in the United States, but all around the world. And it's very exciting to be with you today to talk about it.
How many in Michigan members do you have?
We have tens of thousands. I would say probably in the 25 to 50,000 family range in Michigan.
Can you give us a sense of what the homeschool landscape in Michigan looks like? How many families are choosing this and why?
Well, Cindy, you know, there are tens of thousands of families in Michigan who are homeschooling, and I think Michigan homeschoolers are probably like homeschoolers all over the country. And when they are asked, and there's been research done by the U.S. Department of Education, when they're asked why they're homeschooling, the top three reasons tend to be they're concerned about the environment in the school system. They would like to provide their child with a particular kind of educational content, whether that's faith-based or morality-based education. And the third reason is there is some special reason, some special need that that child has that the parent is looking for some kind of educational opportunity, whether the child's struggling in school or accelerating in school. And they want to provide a more individualized environment for their child.
And Michigan is one of the states with the fewest restrictions and regulations on families who choose to homeschool their kids. And that is something the Homeschool Legal Defense says is good. Why is that, Mike?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We do categorize Michigan as one of the states that has one of the fewest regulations. It's not that there are no regulations. There is a law that says that if you want to homeschool your child, you've got to provide them an organized educational program, or you can educate them under the non-public education law. So there are some regulations that you have to follow. It's not like there isn't anything. But we believe that, you know, parents can be trusted We believe that homeschooling has demonstrated over the last 40 years to be a very effective way of preparing children to take their place in society as effective citizens. They're well socialized. Research suggests that children are very well academically prepared. They do well in college. And so what we found is that the way things are seems to be working fine. In fact, what you see is a trend across the country of actually removing restrictions from homeschooling families as opposed to increasing them. And so Michigan tends to be where most states are actually moving to.
Well, Mike, for those advocates who would like to see the state create some stricter oversight when it comes to homeschooling, there seem to be two separate issues they point to, safety and educational quality. So let's dig into that first one, which is, I dare say, the most contentious. As you know, there have been some cases in Michigan and elsewhere where parents who had pulled their children from public school to homeschool were found to have been abusing their children. A family in Lansing this summer was charged with a child cruelty, allegedly keeping their five children in what authorities describe as a dungeon. And then, of course, the very well-publicized case in Detroit in 2015, where the remains of two children were found in their mother's freezer after she had pulled them from public school and they were homeschooled. Did homeschool laws in these cases create a loophole for these parents to hide abuse of their children?
I wouldn't say so. First of all, I want to say that, you know, those kinds of situations are reprehensible, and our organization condemns child abuse of any kind and every kind. Children deserve to be brought up in a loving, nurturing environment where they can trust that their parents are doing what's best for them. And in fact, that's what you see in the vast majority of the cases. But sadly, we do live in a world where there are some parents who do these kinds of things. These are extraordinarily rare circumstances, even, you know, when you control for homeschooling, public schooling, or private schooling. And so, you know, when you look at these two cases, the fact is that in both of these cases, and there are other cases around the country, very small number, but there are some sad, tragic cases. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, these families are known to the social services entities, and they have a record of some kind. And what's happened is they've fallen off the radar screen from the social services people who have not followed up and have not done perhaps the level of investigation that they should have done. So we would not say that the homeschooling regulation would have prevented that, even if you increased the regulation. Even if you were to require some of the things that some of the proponents of more regulation would suggest, such as annual reporting or submitting assessments or other kinds of things, you know, people who want to do bad things are going to get away with doing bad things no matter how much reporting you put on them. You know, it's the old argument, criminals are going to commit crimes no matter what you do. And so the question then becomes, what level of regulation is appropriate to impose in a free country like ours?
Well, let's talk about the Child Protective Services angle, because that Lansing case had parents with a long track record with CPS, and then pulling the five kids out of public school to be homeschooled because of the way that Michigan is set up. There's homeschooling parents don't have to register with the state or have contact with officials. If there is past involvement with CPS, such as there was in Lansing, with the Lansing case, do you think there should be some additional oversight on homeschooling for those families?
We don't support an increase in regulation of any kind. We think that the tools exist for, in, you know, the state to investigate situations where there are concerns, just as you mentioned, as in this case. Just because those children were removed from the public school to homeschool does not insulate them from investigation. In fact, I would say that what the social worker should have done is they should have, you know, perhaps more aggressively investigated and said, look, these family, we know them. They've been accused of abusing their children. Now they're trying to take their kids out of school. What's going on here? There's nothing to prevent the social workers from investigating further that situation. And it sounds like in this situation, that's what they should have done.
So you're saying it's really on this, on CPS, or it's on the state, on legal authorities to make sure cases like this don't slip through the crack?
Well, of course. Why wouldn't it be their responsibility? They're the ones charged with investigating these cases. They need to do a good job doing it. And Cindy, I want to tell you something.
Sure.
We expect a lot of our Child Protective Services personnel, too much. They are under-resourced and understaffed to handle the number of cases that come in. There are over 7 million instances of child abuse reports in the country every year. There are only 33,000 caseworkers to handle all of those cases, because Child Protective Services is now being charged with more and more investigations, and their policies require them to follow a very broad rubric of investigative protocols they have to do too much. And so what we need to really look at is reforming that system so that when there are situations like this Lansing case or the Detroit case or cases in California or wherever they may pop up, regardless of where they come from and whether homeschooling is involved or not, we need to make sure that we've got caseworkers who have the resources and the time to be able to investigate and to protect these children who are at risk.
Let's talk about the issue of educational quality. And one of the reasons parents are choosing homeschooling over public school, as you say, because they're perhaps unhappy with how their child's being taught. When it comes to academic performance, what do we know about how homeschool students do in comparison with their peers in public school?
Well, I think we could be on pretty safe ground to say they do at least as well and perhaps much better academically than their peers in private and public school. There's a lot of research on this, and mostly what it shows is that children who are homeschooled perform 20 to 25 percentile points higher. There's some studies that show that children who are homeschooled go on to university at a higher rate. They are retained in university. They graduate at a higher rate. They have somewhat higher ACT, SAT scores based on some research that's been looked at. So that's academically how it seems to shake out.
Why is it that homeschooled children are not required to take standardized tests, unlike students in traditional schools?
Well, in some states, they are required to do so.
How about in Michigan?
Michigan, no. There's no requirement for homeschooled students to take any particular test.
Why is that? I'm real interested, just as a mom who has schooled kids, not at home, but why is that?
I think that's a fair question. A lot of people don't actually like children taking tests, and that's teachers too. I mean, when you ask teachers if they like subjecting children to tests and then having to teach to the test, they're not sure that that's actually very representative of how the child is performing, right? Whatever questions they happen to ask, then we decide that's how the children are performing. And that's a very constrained view of the child that doesn't take into account some other factors. So I think when you look at the educational landscape, there are a number of experts who would say maybe standardized tests isn't the best way to determine whether a child is actually doing well. But at the end of the day, to answer your question, that's just how the state of Michigan decided it was going to do it back in 1996 when it passed the law. I said, look, if you want to take on the responsibility of educating your child, make sure you put them into or provide them with an organized educational program and go for it. We trust you parents. And what the research seems to show is it seems to be working.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Mike Donnelly. He's an attorney with the Homeschool Legal Defense Association as we talk about the landscape for homeschooling in Michigan. And Mike, some of the suggested reforms that came up in 2015 included something like having children check in with a mandated reporter, let's say someone like a doctor or a pastor. How much of a burden would that put, in your view, on families who are choosing to homeschool?
Well, I think that's a significant burden for anyone. If we're concerned about children who are being abused, why wouldn't we impose that requirement on everyone? Why is it just homeschool children? I mean, requiring people to go in to see a mandatory reporter, whether it's a social worker or a teacher in the school, seems to be not really the way we do things in this country. We don't presume people are guilty and then until they prove themselves innocent. We presume that people are innocent unless we have reason to believe otherwise, and then we conduct an investigation. And if we find out there are problems, we charge them, we investigate them, and we make sure that justice is done.
So if you think of negative consequences of this suggested reform, what would you see those as?
Well, it's unnecessary. I mean, it's an unnecessary burden that, I mean, okay, so let's say if we're trying to actually prevent child abuse, right? Why would we think that on that one day when the parents take their kids to the mandatory reporter, when we know that the mandatory reporter is going to be looking for signs of child abuse or neglect, that somehow the parent who actually, let's assume they actually are abusing or neglecting their children, like that's actually going to show that.
Mike, overall, is there any oversight that the state could or should implement as safety net measures for our children?
The state of Michigan has very strong oversight mechanisms. You know, people can call in and make a report of abuse or neglect if they are aware of it. I know the state of Michigan follows up on those reports, investigates. Sadly, there are situations, as you've mentioned, and there are others, too, that are not related to home education, but other forms of education. You know, when you look at the sources of reports nationally, and I think this is probably true of Michigan, only 18% come from education sources. 50% or so come from professional, but there's 20% that come from non professional sources, friends, family, neighbors, and another 20% that come from anonymous or other sources. So when you look at where reports come from and the number of reports that come in, it seems to me that as a society, we've done what we should do, given, you know, that we don't want to treat people as guilty until they prove themselves innocent, to provide for opportunities for child abuse or neglect to be, you know, reported, investigated, and followed up on. And these kinds of tragic situations just point out that we've got an overworked CPS caseload, and I hope that people will look at that and consider that as a way to reform the situation and really provide services to children who are at real risk of harm, not looking at things like homeschooling or that sort of thing.
Is there any oversight at all that the state could or should implement to make sure that the educational quality is on par for children who are homeschooled?
I mean, you know, you can look around the country and see there are states that require assessments on an annual basis, some required on every 2 or 3 year basis. There are a majority of states that require very little assessment. In fact, the majority of states don't require any assessment. So I think Michigan fits in the category with the majority that, you know, there is no need to impose any additional oversight. So I just don't think it's necessary.
Mike Donnelly is an attorney with the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, working with homeschool families all across Michigan. Mike, thanks for your time today. We appreciate being able to talk with you.
Cindy, thank you. This is an important area, and I'm glad that you and others are interested in and examining it. It's been a pleasure to be with you today.
Yesterday, we also brought you the voices of some homeschooling parents. Today, a different set of voices. You'll hear from two homeschool alumni who are in favor of reforms. But first, an elementary school principal tells us how Michigan's homeschooling law affects his school.
My name is Fred Abel. I'm a principal of a K-4 elementary school in western Wayne County. We'll have students that enter school, and sometimes there's a conflict, sometimes there isn't, but they'll move, and they'll claim that the parents will claim that they're going to homeschool their students. We'll find sometimes that those students will bounce back to our buildings, and they really have never done any school while they're gone. So quite often the children will actually say that I haven't done school this year. So we probably see students leave and or come to us 2 or 3 times a year that have had that happen. My biggest concern at first is just safety. We see children that don't seem to be in stable homes, and without any law tracking them to know where they are, we know nothing. So we will quite often try to follow up, and I'll ask for information of where they're going, but there's nothing. There's no way to track that they're getting any kind of education, whether they're taking assessments, whether they're growing as young human beings.
My name is Trinity McFadden, and I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I was homeschooled from kindergarten all the way through 12th grade. I had a pretty positive homeschool experience overall. I was really lucky to have parents that were very conscientious about tracking my educational progress. They used great curriculum. They had me attending a cooperative in high school so that I could study subjects like chemistry and speech and debate with other students, which gave me great opportunities for socialization in addition to access to some additional teachers. I think all homeschooled children deserve to have a positive experience, and I think most people want homeschooling to be a positive educational option. But because of that, I think some simple reforms could make a huge impact. Michigan is one of the least regulated states in the nation for homeschooling, which creates some issues around unseen child abuse and educational neglect. I personally knew students who were affected by educational neglect. I knew some students who had learning disabilities that went undiagnosed and affected their education. Many students I knew lacked a real strong education in science and math. I also knew some students who spent more time working in family businesses than they did being educated. And sometimes families were just so large that the youngest children could get left behind, or the oldest children were actually spending more time taking care of younger siblings than getting their own education.
My name is Dean Simmer. I am a native of Michigan. I grew up in Traverse City. I live in Detroit. I was a student in the Traverse City Public Schools through elementary school, and my family made the decision to homeschool. So I homeschooled through high school and graduated as a homeschool student. One of the concerns that I have, and this was never an issue for my family because we were very engaged in our church, in social outings and things of that nature, us being off the grid or off the radar or falling through the cracks really wasn't a thing. But if your motives aren't great or your motives are general suspicion around other people and things of that nature, you can use homeschooling in Michigan to disappear. I also think, you know, and I know this is a sensitive topic, but I think in some way we have to measure progress of some kind in terms of academics. You know, can they read? Can they write at a certain age? Are they learning basic math skills and basic English skills and things like that?
That was Dean Simmer, Trinity McFadden, and Fred Abels. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank, engineered by Peg Watson. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.